And good morning once again, and welcome to the other side of midnight, that magical time. Yeah, we're going to talk about magic tonight. That magical time between dusk and dawn, where the things we look at in daylight take on a kind of a different light at this time of night. And some of the things I want to talk about to start the show kind of convolve into that, starting with, if you go to Radio with Pictures, remember, othersideofmidnight.com, click on the upper right-hand corner, Radio with Pictures, that takes you to the show page. Link number one is a headline coming out of Missouri tonight. Concerned student 1950 movement continues past Monday's moment. And what this is a story relating to the resignation today of two major officials at the University of Missouri, the president and the chancellor. And what I found resonant was this has been spurred by a small group of MU students who basically stared down power and made sure that power was going to work for everyone. And this is a story just beginning. But again, the thread that caught my attention was this stems back to 1950 when the university desegregated. And so the movement is called the Concerned Student 1950 Movement. Needless to say, a whisker away from 19.5. Now, what we're going to talk about tonight is how these threads kind of weave themselves together. We're going to be talking about resonances. We're talking about, in the hyperdimensional model, the torsion field model, how magic is, in essence, ultimately indistinguishable from technology, courtesy of my old friend Sir Arthur C. And this is reflected in the second story under Radio with Pictures. The Egyptians announced today that they, after a couple of weeks of scanning the Giza Plateau, the Giza Pyramids, with some new state-of-the-art infrared scanning equipment, they've apparently detected anomalies, thermal anomalies, geometric anomalies on the surface of the pyramids that indicate to the people that they have contracted with that there could be interior chambers or corridors or rooms or you know, crevices, whatever, that are revealing themselves through a differential heat leakage from the interior to the surface. This, of course, is all occurring simultaneous with the continued, for the fourth or fifth day, discussion in the news by commentators who I'm sure, you know, political commentators, who I'm sure would never in a million years have thought they would be uttering the terms pyramids, Ben Carson, and Donald Trump in the same sentence. Because not only has Ben Carson been regaling us for days with the alternative idea that pyramids are not ancient Egyptian tombs for pharaohs, but in fact are giant granaries for pharaohs and other people in Egypt, which of course brings up by metonymy the idea that they're not tombs, that they're something more, that they're buildings, that they're maybe very interesting, very complex, very geometric, very mechanically sophisticated buildings. And that takes us to Donald Trump, who basically said, no, they're tombs because they're basically, you know, solid on the inside except for that little space for the pharaoh. Again, forget the words and listen to the music. Because we have 19.5 issued on the same day that pyramids are issued, on the same day that we get new imagery from Cydonia, from NASA, and other parts of Mars showing an extraordinary, absolutely extraordinary, breathtaking revelation of geometry stretching on for mile after mile after mile. And we have pyramids on Ceres and pyramids on Mars and pyramids, huge arcology-type pyramids on Pluto, pyramids orbiting Pluto in the form of a couple of its moons that look like aerial arcologies, all of which is kind of like an interesting segue into tonight's guest. Oberon Zell is a renowned wizard and elder in the worldwide magical community and founder and headmaster of the only online secular school of magic, the Gray School of Wizardry. And there is a hot link in his bio under Radio with Pictures tonight. In 1962, Oberon co-founded the Church of All Worlds, the first legally recognized pagan church with a futuristic vision, and he has been involved in the founding of several other major groups and alliances in the years since. Oberon was the first to apply the terms pagan and neo-pagan to the newly emerging nature religions of the 1960s, and through his publication of Green Egg magazine in 1968, he was instrumental in the coalescence of the modern pagan movement. In 1970, he had a profound vision of the living earth, which he published as an early version of the Gaia thesis in the 1980s. He has since raised living unicorns, which toured with the Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus. And finally, but not least, Oberon's latest project is the Academy of Arcana in Santa Cruz, California. Opening soon, the Academy will be a museum and a library of myth, magic, and mysteria, and mystery in the first physical campus for the Gray School of Wizardry, offering classes and workshops and a gift store of curiosities in this time of year. How could we possibly get by without a gift store? Oberon, welcome to the other side of midnight.
Well, thank you. That was really nice of you, Richard. I'm glad to be here.
Well, I want to talk to you about something that has been on my mind for a very long time. Last week, we had kind of a bookend show to this one tonight. We had an old friend of mine, Andrew Mount, who was Dr. Bruce De Palma's right-hand man and executive assistant and participated in many of Bruce's really classic experiments that demonstrate that the science that we think we know, in fact, is a science that is in great imperfect transition to a science that we may come to know once again. And so I guess my first question to you tonight is magic and wizardry and all that goes bump in the night really just another name for a science we have not comprehended in a very long time?
Well, I think you're kind of hitting the nail right on the head there. It seems to me, all of us in the magical world are really quite caught up in the notion that the laws of quantum physics, as they're now being articulated, are virtually identical to the traditional laws of magic. And the things have been called magic. What Arthur C. Clarke said in that quote you referenced, that any significantly advanced or sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. We always say it's a great truth, and so the opposite is also true, that any significantly or sufficiently advanced magic is indistinguishable from science. And I think this is really what we're seeing now as these are coming together, is our science is coming to a greater understanding of the deeper structure of the universe. It's approaching what once was considered the realm of pure magic. And we find that delightful, actually. It's becoming the main conversation among many a campfire these days.
Well, we've been watching these trends for the last several years. I mean, obviously the Harry Potter series has taken, you know, the country and the world by storm and a whole new generation. As I've been watching this ascendance, I've also been watching, you know, other television shows that seem more and more to have as part of their story arcs, part of their plot lines, a real reemergence, a resurgence of magic. Is this part of a larger consciousness trend? In other words, is this reflecting where people are moving and thinking in terms of their ability to get things done? And I mean, when for example, when we look at the current election cycle, there appears to be candidates running who haven't a clue as to how to apply a political process. They're just saying to the people following them, follow me, I'll solve it, I'm a fixer, I'll make it happen. In other words, people seem to be primed for a magical as opposed to a process solution, don't you think?
Well, yeah, that's a very interesting aspect of it. This is one of those great ages of magic that are at a company, the turning of the eons. And we have just been experiencing the very beginning of the turning of the wheel now from Pisces into Aquarius. And a lot of us who have been following the dating structure and the astrological alignments attribute this to the December 21st winter solstice 2012 event there as a shifting of that. So we're just a little bit over the edge now. It's sort of like the year clock is a couple of minutes after midnight on New Year's Eve. And what happens at these eras is reflected in popular culture and mythology, along the same thing. And what that means really is that all kinds of possibilities are up in the air. And magic is the art of probability enhancement, to be quite specific. It's all about the probabilities, which is also the foundation, of course, of quantum physics. So with all these possibilities up, that have the dice are in the air and they haven't landed is what it is, people are responding to that on a deeper level, because all this stuff reaches the deeper level through the quantum field. We keep getting back to that quantum thing. And the emergence in popular literature and fiction shows the beginning of a new mythology around this. And these mythologies turn on the unseen, the unknown places, where it's the realm of probabilities and possibilities. And in any, it says in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, you know, any infinite improbability becomes a finite probability. And because no matter, even if the odds against something are 1 billion to 1, well, there's, 6 or 7 billion people on the planet. So it's going to happen several times inevitably.
Well, one of the old laws of physics that I learned kind of in a cryptic way was whatever is not forbidden is permitted eventually.
Right.
So if you live long enough, you're going to see the most incredible, improbable things come to pass. But we're seeing so many improbable things all coming to pass simultaneously. It appears to me, back to your idea of a world age changing, which parallels very much our idea of the physics changing, that in fact these two are linked together. If we are in fact changing frequencies, changing alignments, changing beat phenomenon, changing the background physics which keeps reality going, how would we look out and see it? How would we know the changes were occurring? Well, one of the ways that I would think would be that things that were formerly kind of segregated in the realm of magic and wish fulfillment and fiction and fantasy, they appear to be taking place more and more in our so-called everyday life.
Well, yes. A few decades ago, I spent a few years raising live unicorns, you know, so something out of Total Fantasy walked the earth for a while and then has been forgotten since, which is really fascinating. But I think that your thing about the resonance is a really crucial factor of that. I mean, we're seeing the deeper vibratory resonances of the planet itself are shifting and coming into different harmonic frequencies. So all of that is happening, you know, and what's emerging is new paradigm. It's Joseph Campbell said in his last book, The Power of Myth, that it's time for a new mythos to emerge. It's a global mythos that includes everybody without separation. And the previous cultural myths that we've had have all been how the stories of how our particular people came to be and how we're different and better than everybody else. And what is emerging now is a global mythos. And the Gaia theory, the Gaia thesis, the Gaia premise, the Gaia mythos addresses that. We're all children of the same mother. We're all part of one vast planetary organism. And when you look at that, everything is interconnected. As the motto of the Gray School has it, a quote from Cicero, everything is alive, everything is interconnected. And this is part of the new mythos that's emerging now in the new paradigm.
Okay, as part of your intro, the material I have in front of me says you are a renowned wizard. Renowned or otherwise, what does a wizard do and how does one become a wizard?
Well, wizardry literally means wisdom, just the same thing. So a wizard is one who is considered wise. Wisdom is really all about considering the consequences. That's really what it's about. I mean, that's how wisdom can be distinguished from foolishness, is considering the consequences. So traditionally, those people who are accounted wise, wizards, philosophers, teachers, mages, sages, you know, elders, wise ones of all kinds, there's many names for such people. The popular one, wizards, is by no means the only one, are considered to be people that you can go to for wise counsel, that will know stuff that other people don't know. And because of that knowledge, they may be able to do things that other people can't imagine doing or think to be impossible. But mainly, they're teachers, guides, mentors. There's important roles for that. All people who fulfill those roles can be considered wizards. And one of the fun things to do is to look at popular myths and stories and try to identify, okay, who's the wizard there, you know? Yeah, obviously, in a story like The Lord of the Rings or Star Wars or something, it's pretty obvious. But even in something like the Spider-Man mythos, you know, you've got Aunt May is really the wizard in the story. She's the one who always speaks the wisdom and guidance. And this is a very important role for people to take in the world at a certain point. When you've been around long enough to have learned a few things and people start coming to you for advice, you have to take look at this as a kind of responsibility that people are counting on you to know what you're talking about. So you better do it.
Well, this is part of a very venerable tradition, the mystery schools, the wisdom keepers. What was your personal journey? I mean, you weren't born a wizard. How did you wind up figuring out, wait a minute, that's what I want to do with the rest of my life?
Well, I think I was born with insatiable curiosity. I really wanted to know everything there was to know. And I came in here pretty direct from my former life, in which I was my maternal grandfather. And that death occurred just shortly before my mother in this life became pregnant. And so I grew up and lived in the same house I died in as a child. And I grew up among the same family that I'd known before. And they always regarded me as uncanny. They would always say things, that's just what your grandfather used to say, or you sound just like your grandfather.
Now,
your grandfather was really into that too. So I had that kind of a start.
Were you aware growing up that you had these memories that seemed to be more than yours?
Very much, very much. But I didn't really know the context to put them in. I just simply knew stuff and remembered stuff that had not happened to me in this life. And I didn't really know how to integrate it, which it took years later on as my studies took me further that I came to understand what that was about, because the Christian family context I grew up in didn't have any context for those sorts of experiences.
So your family around you wasn't aware of this, or if they heard you say something, they just put it down to kids' imagination or whatever?
Well, no, not exactly. That was what was interesting about it. They did, in fact, have some sort of a sense that you know, the grandfather's spirit in some way was continuing to manifest. They just didn't know how to relate it to anything. They didn't understand the concept of reincarnation. It was more like I was channeling somehow, that kind of a thing. But the thing is that sort of, I already had a head start when I came into this world. So my curiosity about things was driven already at that time. And my very earliest reading was children's versions of the Greek myths. And I loved them. I loved the myths. And I went and learned about other myths of other cultures. By the time I was old enough to be sent off to Sunday school, you know, the whole Christian story in the background in the Old Testament Hebrew story was another mythos, which I thought was really cool. And I studied it and enjoyed it. But I never got the notion it was supposed to be the only true one. You know, I never got the notion that the God in the Bible was somehow any truer than Zeus or Ra or, you know, any of the other old gods or Odin or Thor or any of them, all of which I had enjoyed their stories. And eventually that led me into from mythology to fantasy and science fiction. And it's in science fiction where my explorations really blossomed, because science fiction is mythology. But it's conscious mythology. It's not mythology about a long ago past. It's visionary mythology about the possibilities in the future.
Unless it's history, which is another discussion. So, okay, so you're growing up and you realize you've got these memories. How long did you drag them into your teen years, into your later years, or did they kind of go away, you know, recede?
Well, some of them were really deep and pervasive. The experience of dying was one that took a long time to recede into the past. It was triggered many times by other events that precipitated the same kind of feelings. But mainly, I think it was just it became less specific memories of events, although there's a few of those that still stand out. I still remember absolutely clearly as if they happened in this life, and I only found out years later from my parents that, no, in fact, that was your grandfather who had that experience, not you. But mostly it was the affinity for stuff. As my grandfather, I was very much into nature. I would disappear for a month every summer and go out into the woods on a camping trip and stuff. I found photos from those eras, but the rest of the family didn't have any idea. And then I'd come home with things. We had a pet squirrel that lived in the house and a giant snapping turtle, and these came from some of those expeditions. And I carried that into my current life. I've adopted many wild animals. I worked with Wildlife Rescue, have raised many a critter, especially possums and owls, two critters I've had a lot of fondness for. And my affinity with nature and camping and woodcraft, I've lived a lot just out in the woods, spent many years just homesteading in the mountains in Northern California and building a home and all of that from scratch. So all of that is there, but the part you're talking about, the wizardry, the mystery, the magic, you know, it was all a continuity. I was fascinated by science. I studied everything I could in science. I took every course and class in science that there was in all the realms because I wanted to know all that cool stuff. But I never really felt that magic was completely separate from that because that was experiential, you know, and I had lots of experiences that confirmed it. And, of course, even more so when I got into psychedelics, and that really opened my eyes a great deal to it all.
This was in the heyday of psychedelics in the 60s, of course.
Yes, of course. Absolutely. Mm. 60s. Mostly the 70s for me, actually. My first acid trip was in 1970 at the occasion of a solar eclipse that passed through the middle of the country in April, I think, or March or April of that year.
Well, that must have been interesting.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
There was one up and down the East Coast in the 70s in March of 1970, mm-hmm. which I chased in an Air Force jet with a telescope and TV cameras and broadcast equipment and all that.
There's a big one coming up in 17, you know.
Yeah, there's
across the entire country.
There's one going to cross the whole country, and we have to be in the right position to measure more measurements around the eclipse. We did one here in Albuquerque back a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. So let me ask you about the Church of All Worlds. How does one collect the moxie to found a church?
Well, you know, people have often said things like, you really think outside the box. And for me, it's like box. There's a box. It never occurred to me that I couldn't do anything I wanted to do, you know, and I was inspired by reading Stranger in a Strange Land by Robert Heinlein, a book that I think many of the people who might be your listeners have probably read, you know. And it was an amazing myth. It was structured as a myth. It was designed and built that way. But there have been a very few stories that have ended and handed the story over to the reader or the viewer, in the case of movies, to carry it forward. And Stranger in a Strange Land is one of those. At the end of the story, the reader has become a part of the story, really, a part of the community of people that have developed throughout the story and who've taken on the name of the Church of All Worlds to indicate the inclusiveness of the vision. And in that, there were premises that just were not found anywhere else. For example, there were priestesses, and only pagan churches have priestesses. There were the immanent divinity concept, thou art God and thou art goddess, was a profound theological concept that had is about sexuality that laid the foundation. And many, many other things. It was just brilliant because the whole perspective was to look at all aspects of human culture from an outsider perspective. And this is the kind of thing only science fiction can really provide us, that mirror to see ourselves from another view. That's the beauty of science fiction. So I read that, and in it, Mr. Heinlein said that a church is a null area in the law, and if you can incorporate your system as a church, you can pretty much do anything you want, and that sounded brilliant. Now, about around that, not at the same time, it was actually sometime later, but there started appearing articles about why we need a new religion. For example, that one by that title by John Poppe that was published in Look magazine in 1970, one of the last issues. And the idea of that religion has taken us so far, but it is broken down. Because religion means relinking, and that's what religions ought to be doing. But instead, we see all these different ones that are competing with each other, and they're fighting for supremacy, and they all want to rule the world, and they all have the one true right and only way. And that's not functional in a diverse, complex world. You know, you just can't go on that way, that we are the chosen people. We are the only ones that have it right. Everybody else is a heretic and should be burned at the stake. You know, we can't have that. So this was a vision of the kind of religion that we might have that would be all-inclusive and that would recognize the divinity within everyone and every sentient being, all of life, as a quality, not an entity. It was powerful stuff. And so it began, the book came out as the Science Fiction Book Club Book of the Year selection in October of 1961. And I and my best friend, first friend I'd met in college, Lance Christie, read it. And on April 6th of 1962, we shared water, which was the essential act of communion in the novel. And it's a good one because it's a true thing. It's not just symbolic. Water is the essence of life. Mm. And the water in this glass that I'm drinking from right now is the same water that is throughout the universe. There's no separate waters. That you pour them all together and they all just all flow together, you know?
Well, Frank Herbert recognized the same truth in Dune in roughly the same time frame.
Precisely. So that was a visionary thing, the universality of water. And of course, now we're finding it all over the universe. We're learning that all the water of Earth came from space. We're finding it beneath the dust of Mars and the craters of the moon and Mercury and the Jovian and Saturnian moons with oceans beneath icy crust and the comets that very likely have carried the seeds of life throughout the universe, and so on it goes. It's all about the water, and water is one of the very first compounds, maybe the very first compound, oxygen and hydrogen, from some of the very first elements to be forged in the hearts of stars. So it's a pretty cool thing, the idea of sharing water to recognize our unity and communion with each other and with all of life.
So you wanted to basically create a foundation, a framework, the Church of All Worlds, that you had adopted from Bob Heinlein's book, right?
Yep. That was it. And we just took it and ran with it. And I corresponded with him extensively for a number of years and asked him questions about what he had in mind with Stranger in a Strange Land and stuff. And it was very interesting. But the main gist of it was that he said he was not trying to provide answers, and that we don't ask because we're so embedded in our culture that we can't even formulate the questions. We have to that Stranger in a Strange Land provided was to step outside of our culture and look at it with that alien anthropologist perspective.
Tell you what, why don't you hold it there? We've got a couple of connection problems that we're going to try to work on during this break. We're at the bottom of the hour. My guest this morning is Oberon Zell. He is a wizard. He is the founder of a school of wizardry. We're going to get into that in the next segments. And we're going to talk about the connection between wizardry and magic and Arthur Clarke and sufficiently advanced technology. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. You're on the other side of midnight. We shall return. And we are back with my guest this morning, Oberon Zell, a wizard, Oberon Zell, a wisdom keeper, an elder. So you had this incredibly audacious idea, stemming from Bob Heinlein's classic, to found a church. How does one go about founding a church? And it's not just any church. This is a church to nature, to history, to the ancients, to process, to integration of systems as opposed to the separation. It's one heck of a church.
Thank you. Well, you know, I'd spent a good deal of time in my life studying religion. I was fascinated by it. I was very active in the church my parents were involved in, and I took every course in comparative religions I could find when I went to college, and I read all the books on the world's great religions and all the different scriptures and different translations of the Bible and all stuff. I was just fascinated with the whole idea of religion, and I also developed some sense of how it works and how churches work and what they should do. And I always felt, as I often do when I decide to do something, that maybe I could do better than what was out there. So I looked at what was out there and said, well, you know, it should be a little more of this and a little more of that, and then I'd be happier with it all. And eventually you end up with a whole new thing. And most religions have been founded by people who really started out just to reform the one they grew up in, which wasn't going to go for it, really. But, you know, well, that wasn't my desire so much to reform them. Being immersed in science fiction, I was already for something starting from scratch.
Why did you have ideas? Why did you think people, forgetting Bob Heinlein for a second, why did you think people needed another religion? I mean, of all the things we need on this planet tonight, another religion does not come to the top of my list.
Well, no, I thought we needed religion. I thought we needed something that actually would do what religion was supposed to do, which was to, you know, unite and unify people and stuff and develop inclusivity and answer questions, or at least ask the right kind of questions, and not have dogma and not have requirements and not have, you know, heretics and all the rest of that kind of stuff. But it should have the good stuff. There's lots of good stuff in the concept of religion. It's churchianity that seems to be the problem, that institutionalization of it, that somebody starts telling other people what to do. So one of the things that was very interesting, really, is when Lance and I started to formulate this and realized that we were not just starting a water brotherhood, which is what we started, really, just a kind of a group of friends who read the book and shared water. Eventually, we decided that we really did want to start a church. It needed to be organized and legally established. But we didn't want it for 1,000 years later to have people burning people at the stake and waging holy wars in our name, you know, because that's, you know, I'm sure that was not what Jesus had in mind, you know. And yet that's what happened. 1,000 years after his teachings of peace and love and forgiveness, people were doing horrible, horrible things in his name. So we had to figure out what went wrong, and we analyzed it. We analyzed it all. One of the key elements we felt that was embedded in the system from the beginning was the idea of monotheism, that one true right and only way notion, you know. And so we had to address that. We had to address it with a notion of, well, the Vulcan idic, you know, infinite diversity and infinite combinations. So embedding a concept of cherishing diversity into this new religion we were formulating became key. And there were lots of others too. The idea of exclusivity, that the idea of the chosen people, the ideas of proselytizing, missionaries, and we didn't want anybody who didn't want to be here, you know. And there was just so much, and we made whole analysis of this. And I've been doing workshops on that sort of thing lately, and trying to find the antidotes in a new meme. And we started off with just the Church of All Worlds, and we put it out there, and we came out in public, and really for the first time in 1967, some years after we had started with our little secret water brotherhood. And the first thing that happened when we came out and said, okay, we're the Church of All Worlds, is people said, well, what kind of a church are you? Are you some kind of Christian sect? Are you one of these new Eastern religions that are coming up?
And wasn't this in the same time frame as Scientology?
Yep, in the same time frame as Scientology and Krishna consciousness and all these other things, the Moonies were just starting to come out, all this stuff. So, you know, it wasn't like we were the only people out there putting out the concept of new religion. So people wanted to know where we fit. And when that question was asked of me, I uttered the fateful response, well, I guess you could say we're pagans. And that seemed to be the first time anybody had said, we're pagans. Pagans had always been that thing that other people were, you know, those pagans, you know.
But never. Oh, I remember reading about them in catechism class, yeah.
Exactly.
The pagans, oh, them pagans over there.
Huh? Yep, well, that's us.
So you stood up and said, hey, we're the pagans.
Right, Exactly.
I mean, the term paganism actually exist as a scientific definition in archaeology, in history, prehistory?
It does. It's a term that is found in anthropological literature referring to indigenous folk religions of different places. Oddly enough, particularly mentioned in descriptions in those days of African religions. If you look at the Man, Myth, and Magic books, the chapter on Africa is all about describing how this is a pagan religion and why and what it is about it and what the characteristics and attributes are and the theology, things like animism and polytheism and all this. So the term had been around as used by anthropologists. And, of course, it goes back to Roman times. It's the Latin word means people of the land, of the country. And it in French, that is paysan, which in English is peasant.
Mm. So
the word peasant really is simply a derivative of the word pagan, and it means people of the land. So we liked that. We felt that we wanted to be people of the earth, people of the land. And we liked the stories and the myths and the mythologies and the holiday customs. All that stuff is pagan, all that familiar stuff, the legends and tales of ancient times, for whether it's, Jason and the Golden Fleece or Arthur and the Round Table of Camelot. All these things are part of what we consider to be pagan culture, really,
but when
especially
you,
the holiday customs.
When you start getting into the holidays, and we're coming up on a whole spate of them right now,
yeah.
From our work, totally separate from what you're going to tell the audience, is I have been finding the most extraordinary connections between the holidays, the kind of ambience around the holiday, the mood, the flavor, the thing we're supposed to celebrate, the ritual, and the physics underlying it in terms of human mood and human consciousness, and things happen in the spring that don't happen in the fall. It's not mirror symmetric in terms of an orbit around the sun and all that. So at what point did you realize that these dates, these rituals, these holidays, these celebrations actually had a deeper underlying rhyme and reason? They weren't just arbitrary.
Oh, that was one of the most profound insights as the pagan community started to come together, is the unearthing and resurrection and revivifying of the whole wheel of the year, the understanding that all these cycles of festivals are associated with all these popular customs and days like Christmas and Easter and Halloween and all this stuff were actually tied to much more ancient things that related to the solstices and the equinoxes and the cross-quarter days between them for a cycle of eight major festivals on the wheel of the year. And the customs for these are virtually universal in the temperate zones, and they reverse themselves in the southern hemisphere where summer and winter are reversed. And the more you, the deeper you get into this, the deeper you find the universality across cultures. And I've written quite a lot on the holiday customs of the Wheel of the Year around. I've got a whole book out on that subject called Creating Circles and Ceremonies and such. So that was really profound. And so at, say, Christmas time, we're celebrating winter solstice, we're celebrating Yule, we're celebrating Hanukkah, we're celebrating, well, now Kwanzaa, which has been thrown in, just made up because they had to have something. Mm. Soyal with the Lakota and Hopi peoples and do that.
And we're celebrating being on the other side of our star.
Yes.
From the center of the galaxy.
Exactly.
And that influence in the physics that we're measuring, because remember, we're looking at instruments and graphs and computer charts and all that.
Mm-hmm.
When you can actually look at the year as it unfolds in this instrumentation and see the different seasons have different resonances, different frequencies, different waveforms, you can actually chart the fact that we're immersed in this moving, churning matrix that has got to have some influence in our daily lives, and you came at it from the opposite direction. You decided to form a religion, and then you discovered that this ancient stuff actually has meaning like an iceberg. It's much deeper than you might think.
Exactly. And that's kind of been the path of the Church of All Worlds, is that as we've continued to evolve. Another thing, we didn't try to set it in stone like with established scripture and beliefs. We created something designed to evolve and assimilate new information. And we just keep going deeper and deeper. And as we've connected with other cultures, I've been privileged in the last 50 years or so to have been all over the world and to have sat down with traditional shamans and elders of many different cultures and talk about stuff. And we're all talking about the same thing. We have the same understandings. We all understand that the earth is alive, for example, and the, you know, the Great Mother, that's universal. And the turning of the eons and the awakening, the approaching of the awakening is a major theme that resonates across cultures through all the peoples. And, you know, we all sit around and we laugh our asses off at the same kind of stuff. It's wonderful. I'm sure you've had the experience of connecting with shamans of different cultures and knowing, realizing that we're all on the same path here, you know?
My most memorable experience was with Robin when we went to Cal, and I'm sitting on the top of a pyramid measuring it with the Accutron technology, and he's looking at the screen, and he's looking at me, and he's got this kind of look of wonder, and he says, "My grandmother used to tell me about these energies, but I never thought I'd see them," because we're sitting there and we're watching the cosmic amplification of the pyramid we're sitting on interacting with this etheric flow of something and changing the measurements even as we watched. And he was like a little kid. It was like he'd always been told it was real. But suddenly, there it was, and he could reach out and touch it, and it was changing as we watched.
That's wonderful, a wonderful experience. Yeah, and that sort of thing is happening all over the place. The shamans of the world are just as excited with the new developments in the kind of higher energy physics and measurement systems that you're working with and quantum theory as the rest of us are. They just think this is wonderful, you know.
So in terms of forming the church, when did it occur to you that you needed a school to go along with the church? I mean, every Catholic church has a school, right, you know, to go along with the rectory and with the church and with the ceremony and the ritual. So when did you figure out you needed the gray school of wizardry?
Well, that's very interesting.
And where does the term gray come from?
Well, the term gray is reference to the neutralization of all the colors, of course. I mean, it's neither black nor white nor any other color. It's in between them all. It's gray. So that helps to avoid that kind of a thing. And we jokingly say it also refers to the gray in our beards and hair, which is certainly true. It came out of the Gray Council, which is a council of wizards. And so this was sort of the outgrowth of that. But the concept of a school for this was embedded in the very beginning. It could have gone either way. We could have founded a church or a school, but we just didn't have the energy to do both in those days. And as we looked around, there were lots of new schools coming out that were pretty cool. Montessori, Walden School and stuff, Waldorf schools, I mean. Mm-hmm. There were lots of good books out at that time on new educational ideas like Walden 2 and Summerhill and so on. And we read all that. I took every course they had in teaching as well. I got teacher certificate. I taught school for a number of years, public school and private school, and at all ages, actually, from Head Start right on up to college. And so we really thought a lot about, well, should we be doing a school or should we do a church? But we felt that a church was more needed because nobody else was really doing the kind of church and religion that we felt needed to be. So we kind of put the school on the back burner. But, you know, in 1962, when we first shared water, one of our major mythos that came out of that in that year was the comic book series of the X-Men, which took place in the school, you know, Professor Xavier's School for Exceptional Children, mm-hmm. or Gifted Children. And I always had that in the back of the mind, but we had to wait until the time was right. I'd been doing workshops and lectures at pagan festivals and gatherings for years on the need to offer our teachings and our magic and our lessons to our next generation.
Okay, let me stop there, because something that I've been saying based on our own work is that you can't surf unless surf is up.
Right.
And from our measurements, surf is now up. Do you see from the totally different perspectives of the school and the church and the pagan, you know, ideas that, you know, surf is kind of up, that we're reaching this climax in the energies and the whatever you want to call it, and the things that were used to be impossible are now in the realm of the possible?
Precisely, Richard. In fact, we refer to it, to working magic, as surfing the synchronicity wave. And the surf rose to surfable levels with the publication of the Harry Potter books. That's what really did it. Suddenly the world was ready for a school of magic and the concept of wizards and all the rest of it.
Or was it that Rawlings couldn't write that until Cerf was up and then it worked and it wouldn't have worked before?
Well, you know, it's hard to know. Sometimes you think you're doing the magic and you find the magic is doing you. You know? It's all a part of it. There is no real separation. Robert Anton Wilson said you can't write fiction, you know, when he was doing the Illuminata stuff. He would write about things, and then these things would be discovered. And it was like, wow, who's doing this?
You know? He said some really weird things about me in those novels.
Yeah?
Yes. Well, we won't go into that tonight.
Okay.
So you decided to form a church. Why a church? I mean, to me, churches have always been the barrier between you and the Godhead, between you and reality, between you and the ineffable. Why another human institution, a church?
Well, I don't know what else we could have called it. A church means a community of people who are on the same wavelength, really. And we really felt we had to provide an antidote to the bad name given to churches and religion by the millennia of churchianity, which I really am very unhappy with. I'm unhappy about that the same way I'm unhappy at the bad name that a lot of jerky men have given to men, you know, that kind of thing. So we felt that we could do better, and we needed to do that. But I've often thought about it. Sometimes I've thought that I would have rather renamed it from the beginning. Instead of calling it the Church of All Worlds, maybe I should have called it the Church of Your Choice, because we'd get lots of free advertising that way from all these billboards that say, attend the Church of Your Choice.
Yes.
That's pretty much what we're all about, really, is that. And
well,
we just felt
see,
that was necessary.
Again, in that time frame, another famous church, a modern church, created out in essence, you know, out of magic, was Scientology. And we now know an awful lot about Scientology that some of us wish that we didn't. And we identify certain very famous people with the Church of Scientology. How come you guys didn't go in that direction, having spokespersons that people would relate to in terms of these much more inclusive ideas that are not institutional churches, but more the idea of community?
I wish we did. I wish we would appeal to more of the more, you know, famous popular spokespeople who would give us the same kind of promotion that some of them have given to, say, Scientology. I guess we just haven't appealed to those sort of people because we're not trying to control people. We're trying to liberate people. We're trying to support people in living their own lives and making their own choices and relating. In the Church of All Worlds, we have one commandment, precisely one, and it's be excellent to each other. A tip of the hat to Bill and Ted's.
I was just going to say, it sounds vaguely
It is, yes, I know. But it was great. I mean, how can you do better than that? And what else do you need? You know, if that's the one commandment you've got, you really don't need any others. And so we've tried to operate on that premise, and it just hasn't had the appeal that, you know, to the rich and powerful or whatever. But we would certainly be very happy if we had more of that. It's sort of annoying to watch groups that we think are really, in many ways, well, less than ideal, shall we say, and to be generous. That they're, you know, that they're the ones that have all the popular appeal and all the support and all the money and stuff.
Well, have you ever gone on a kind of recruiting, you know, drive?
Yeah, it works for us.
No, I don't mean with just the general population. I'm talking about stars, people that might be spokespersons for an extraordinary idea, Church of Choice.
The Church of Your Choice, right.
So I guess you didn't hear the question.
No.
Oh, did you ever go looking for any visible, famous spokespersons to represent the church?
Well, not really, not specifically. We've just never been into recruiting or proselytizing. It's more like people have to find their way to us. All the pagan groups are like that. It's just sort of a part of the pagan meme in general is that we really resent the idea of people going around trying to convert other people, and so we don't want to do it ourselves. If people are interested, they can find their way, and we don't always make it easy. Although it's easier now than it used to be, certainly. It was one of the reasons why I felt that we needed to create the Grey School of Wizardry, is that seeing the incredible popularity of the Harry Potter phenomenon, we realized that all these kids, especially, who are turned on by that, are going to want to come looking for the real thing. And the thing about the Harry Potter mythos is that unlike a lot of the other fantasy tales that take place, you know, through the magic wardrobe or somewhere over the rainbow or in another galaxy long ago and far away, the magic realm in the Harry Potter mythos is right here. It's right around, and that the implication is that magical people are, you pass them by on the street, you know, down some alley or down some path or in some place out of sight, they may be getting together and doing stuff. Well, it's true, we are, you know, and we laugh about that. We all joke at that, yep, we're those people, all right. And we do all that stuff. So given that aspect of the mythology, it just seemed like the time was right for us to come out. And the response has been tremendous. It's obviously there is a resonance there. People are looking for this. And why are they looking for this right now? I think the reasons you gave earlier, that it's a time of uncertainty and people are looking for something that makes sense, something that's deep enough to ring true into their hearts. And I think that all of us who find our way into paganism have that feeling. We don't have a feeling of conversion that we suddenly, saw the light. The feeling that people get coming into paganism is a feeling that, oh, I'm not the only one. You mean there are others who feel the way I've always felt? I feel like I've come home. And out of that comes the most beautiful words that you hear at every pagan gathering and that are blazoned in big banners across the entryway, which is welcome home.
So how does one join the Church of All Worlds?
Well, I'm glad you asked. You can just go to the website. Right now we have a website, caw.org, caw.org. And that's all the information is there about the church, and there's a button to join up if you want to. Or you can look it up on Wikipedia for a more objective thing. It's all very out there now and available. And if anybody is interested in following up on it, we're, you know, glad to have you and come along as far as you want to go.
I remember years ago when I was working and living in New York, I had a very good friend of mine who was bureau chief for NPR. That was her day job. Her night job, she was a witch. In fact, I think you know, yes, Margot. And yes. And I watched her write this very first book, you know, that she'd ever written called Drawing Down the Moon.
Right.
And I understand that you guys actually have a chapter in her book. Well, needless to say, when I knew her, I had no idea you existed. And when I called up, you know, a few weeks ago to talk to Joy, who's going to join us during the conversation part of the show, you know, about some of the things that you guys have been doing, and I happened to bring up Margot's name, she says, oh, we're in chapter so-and-so.
Right.
So tell me about you being in chapter so-and-so.
Well, it depends on which book you're talking about. We've got a bit of a amusing mention in her biography, her autobiography, Heretic's Heart. But in Drawing Down the Moon, it's an analysis of the emergence of the whole pagan movement and all the different groups. And she contacted us first about this, and I had been collecting information because I was publishing Green Egg magazine, which is the oldest and most continuous and probably most influential pagan publication. It's now online, and you can look it up, greenegg magazine.com. And so she came to visit us, to Morning Glory and I, and we talked about the idea that it would be great to write this book, and I've been gathering material because we've been publishing all these articles from all these different groups, and I had these big files that were all full of that, but I just didn't have time to work on the book. I was too busy publishing the magazine and running the church and stuff, so I gave the files to her, and she used that as a basis for then traveling around and interviewing all these people that came down into the book. So the Church of All Worlds and us personally had a pretty major part in the book itself, both in its conception and its execution. And she talked about the influence that CAW had, Church of All Worlds, and the Green Egg had, and all of that. And it was very nice. Margot was a wonderful person. I was so sad that she died last year. She died a few months before, or right around the time of Morning Glory's death, too. Both of these amazing women died within just a couple months of each other last year.
Yeah, it was a shame.
Yeah.
So, okay, in terms of the school, if you join the church, do you begin a kind of a educational program of various backgrounds, history, spells? I mean, what role does spell and ritual play in this church versus in some of the more, shall we say, off-putting descriptions of other churches and other worship services?
Well, for the first off, you need to distinguish between the school, the Grace School of Wizardry, and the church. The Grace School is entirely secular. It's not associated with the church, and we welcome students of all religions. We have you know, Christians and Muslims and Buddhists and Jews and pagans, of course, all studying magic happily together in the Grace School of Wizardry. In the Church of All Worlds, we have a series of 9 concentric circles that were originally conceptualized in the book Stranger in a Strange Land to represent the orbits of what at that time were felt to be 9 planets. But now we know that the outermost one is really just a big old, I don't like the word dwarf planet. I like the planetoid. And we had a perfectly good word, planetoid.
Oberon. Pluto is a planet. I hate to break it to you. Pluto is a planet. Okay.
No, it's a planetoid. It's not a planet. But no, anyway, that's another
planet. Thing.
But what it does connect us with is the Oort cloud and the Kuiper belt. Like that. It's what connects with the outer world. And as people study, and we have study programs that are part of the system, then you can migrate in through the circle system. It's quite a wonderful educational system. The whole thing is designed to promote self-actualization and personal expansion and such, and also to take on more and more responsibilities in running things. So ritual is a pretty important part of it, because we use ritual for lots of stuff. Celebrating the 8 seasonal festivals, so the Wheel of the Year is a major ritual cycle, and other events and stuff that are not too much different than things other people celebrate. You know, weddings we call hand fastings, baby blessings, birthings, cronings, and saging when people come to their elder years. Rites of passage for kids coming up. There's lots of little rituals of life, birthdays. You know, and all of these, we have a conceptual framework in which all these are part of a greater story that we weave into it, the story of the year cycle and the story of the life cycle all brought together. We use that language. We talk about the autumn years, you know, or the springing of our life and stuff. And it's all part of the same system. So okay. Our ritual cycle is designed to provide context and continuity for our lives in connection with the larger universe and the turning of the wheel around us.
Well, hold it there then, because we are on a wheel. We're at the top of the hour on a clock.
Okay.
The Other Side of Midnight. My guest this morning is Oberon Zell, Archwizard of the School of Wizardry and the Church of All Worlds. Here on The Other Side of Midnight, my name is Richard C. Hoagland, and this is the music of Nick Skouros and Chris Morford. We shall return. And we are back with my guest this morning, Archwizard Oberon Zell. I love saying that, Archwizard.
All right.
There's a picture on the Other Side of Midnight .com website, othersideofmidnight.com. Go to Radio with Pictures. There's a photo of you staring into a crystal skull. Obviously, there's a story attached to that. What's the story?
Well, not as much as you'd think, perhaps. there was I was slated to be on the cover with an interview about the Gray School when I first started it, and they needed a cover photo. So basically, we just set up the picture and took it there. And I have quite a collection of different sorts of skulls, one of my fascinations, and had one of them was this crystal skull, so I thought it would be kind of a cool thing to be holding in it in my hand at the time. And the outfit that I'm wearing is my wizard robes that I created myself for ritual, and it all seemed to be nice, and people liked it. So that kind of became my basic identity picture as the headmaster of the Great School of Wizardry.
Now,
in fact, I got a great big life-size painting that somebody did for me of that, which is really quite nice.
It hangs, wow.
Yeah.
So is this one of the original crystal skulls? Because there's only, I think, maybe a dozen or so that are, quote, real. And there's a lot of fakes.
It's not, although I do know somebody who knows somebody who has one of the two or so original ones. But no, this one is just a replica, which I have. It's I have this museum collection, and many things are replicas.
Part of the talents of being a wizard is you're supposed to be able to connect with objects or memorabilia or artifacts or things that carry a kind of an interesting charge or information content. Have you ever tried scrying an actual crystal skull?
I have not tried scrying an actual crystal skull, but I have definitely tried scrying with regular crystal balls.
Oh.
And
what happens?
Well, I didn't have as much success as all that. The trick seems to be to go into a kind of a trance, and then the stuff just kind of runs out and runs on into you like that. And in the times that I've actually tried to do this, I haven't really had much success. But I think if I were to try again with my consciousness properly altered, I might be having better luck with it. But I have had better luck with psychometry, which is sort of reading the energies of things. I've had people come to me with something, a piece of jewelry or a stone that they picked up, and ask me, do you feel the energies of this? What can you tell me about it? And I very often have gotten some really amazing insights and just blurted out whatever came to me. And they go, oh, that's amazing. That's I'm not sure that's something that I can really do consciously. There are people who do this seriously, and people pay them for it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I have gotten some really interesting hits, and occasionally they've been significant from different objects. So that's psychometry is what that's called, and it's a little different than scrying. I've had better luck scrying with a black mirror, a concave black mirror with a little water in it in the moonlight. That works really well. You get some incredible images and stuff that way.
Hmm. Okay, in terms of the School of Wizardry, I guess I want to back into the idea of the practicality of magic in an era of science when most people don't realize the two are two sides of the same coin. How do you teach people to apply magic practically in their individual lives?
Well, that's a very good question. First, you have to kind of understand that the modern analog of wizard really is professor, and that's kind of the way the whole thing operates. And the application in one's life is to bring consciousness and attention to everything that you do. The basis of any magic spell is what we call the statement of intention, the statement of intent in which you articulate what it is you're trying to accomplish. So the very fact of articulating that is itself an act of magic. The first magic spell that we ever learn as children, and we all learn it, is the birthday wish. You're blowing out the candles on the birthday cake.
Oh, yes, yes.
That's a magic spell. You make a wish. You don't tell anybody who it is. You blow out the candle. All the candles and blow it out in one breath. Your wish will come true. This is magic.
I'm trying to remember whether that was the first one my parents taught us or when you see a shooting star, you know, after sunset. Quick, make a wish.
Well, that's another one, and the first star I see tonight, which is usually Venus, is another one. Starlight, star bright, first star I see tonight, wish I may, wish I might, have this wish I wish tonight. It's these things have little verses that go with them a lot. But really magic is all about the intention and focalizing it, and if you can focus on something and hold it in your mind and attention, the really powerful stuff, I've found that I find that sex magic is a really powerful way to get something. If you can hold something, your attention on a desired goal, you know, through the experience of raising the energy level that high and hold it through, it can be quite powerful. And it's not that complicated. But when I'm working on a project and need something, like I do logo designs. It's one of the things I do as a graphics artist. and I will study the concepts and what has to go into it, and then I will take it into the dreaming deliberately with an obsession in my mind with it, and I'll deliberately set up a dreaming scenario where I take a drink from a glass of water in the morning, at night, and then in the morning I'll take another drink that will revive the memory, and I get the images in dreams of what it is I'm looking for, and it's just that's just the way I work with it.
So let me stop. So you're doing logo design. Mm-hmm. And you're doing these rituals to impel your subconscious to kind of hone in on the deeper level symbolism and meanings of certain designs you can then, back in the conscious world, enfold into a design that you present to a customer or a client or whatever you're using it for.
Precisely.
Oh, wow.
Precisely.
And how often does it work? How often do you get the right match, the right resonance?
Every time, because I work myself up into an obsession. I get to where, you know, I'm so obsessed with what I'm trying to do that I'm dreaming about it at night. You know, that's we do that with lots of things. If we're working on a project, if we're trying to write a book, you know, as an author, you know this, and you get to a point where you're thinking about it in your sleep, even. And that's the way you do it, really. And you can just apply that to other types of things. I do it with my writing as well as my art, of course. And then it comes through. The discovery of the DNA molecule came that way. The discovery of the benzene ring came that way as a dream image. And there's stories about this. There's lots of stories in the scientific literature about how concepts and such came through in dreams.
Yeah, I think Francis Crick admitted to doing a little LSD before he had one of his major insights.
True, and that's a way of accessing that hemisphere that is the dreaming hemisphere. We have the speech process that goes on in the left hemisphere in the Wernicke's area over the ear, and in the right hemisphere in the equivalent space we have the dream activity that goes on at night when we're sleeping, and this accesses the archetypal realms, and it's different. And we can switch back and forth between these and learn how to access both sides intentionally in our sleeping or dreaming. And psychedelics and hypnosis and music, there's lots of ways of shifting that locus of our consciousness from one hemisphere to the other. Psychedelics aren't by any means the only one. Meditation, there's lots of stuff that does that.
Like,
but they're an easy one and an effective one.
Like, well, I guess I'm going to converge on your same answer, because I'm going to ask now, in terms of actually doing this, given that you've been at this a very significant amount of time, have you noticed it changing? In other words, our model is the physics is making this stuff easier to connect.
Wow, I'm so glad you asked that. I have, in fact. I've noticed that less and less do I require the training wheels to do things. You know, early on with the stuff, it required all the setup, you know, all the you know, drawing diagrams on the floor and all kinds of stuff and the right colors of candles and all that, which puts you there. Because the principle of associations and the tables of correspondence that are part of the magical cookbooks, the grimoires, really, that's how you set things up. But if you do enough of it, you know, it becomes subconscious itself, and you don't have to do all the exercises anymore. Mm-hmm. These days, I find it almost alarming how often that I just think something or want something or visualize something or have a notion or an idea, and things just start moving in that direction.
But you see, that's what the model is predicting should be happening.
Yes, it
is. The background physics is really what makes magic easier, because mm-hmm. we're more in touch and connection with the matrix, which is molding us, and we mold it, you know, like the Ouroboros, the snake eating its tail.
Precisely.
As the physics is changing, again, in our model, it should be easier to do all this without going through the complicated rituals. Like, the rituals are kind of the over-technology, whereas the actual operator is the human being in connection, and the connections are now easier because the physics is making the connections now easier.
Precisely. The neural pathways have been opened. The morphogenetic field has created a deeper resonance. It's easier to tap in. The best way to know that you're really functioning in the magical realm, and I've told people about this with the changing of the eon, is when you start seeing more remarkable synchronicities, the sort of stuff we used to call coincidences, but in the magical field we say there are no coincidences, there are synchronicities, which is not entirely correct. There are actually coincidences, but synchronicities are the meaningful ones. You know, and when we see those, it's like standing on the seashore and you'll see the waves coming and lapping at the beach. And then every now and then some bigger waves will come in. And and as they resonate with each other and several waves come together to create a harmonic, they'll lift up even higher. And if you're a surfer, you're looking out there watching for that wave that's big enough to catch it. And you've got to see it coming. And that's a lot the way magic works. The metaphors for things like surfing and magic and river running and magic, there are lots of them that work really well. And that's why we say that doing magic is surfing the synchronicity wave. So I tell people who want to know if they're going to be on the magic or how they can tell if it's working, to just take note of the synchronicities that start appearing. And if you start noticing that stuff, it gets to be quite uncanny. Mm. Robert Anton Wilson referred to the rule of 23, you know, that if you seize on a number like 0111, you know, or something, you will find yourself how many times looking at the clock and by damn, it's 1111. Wow. You know, that kind of stuff.
1111 actually has a very interesting deep meaning in the physics, and maybe we'll get time to get to it, or we won't. I wanted to add joy to the conversation. Okay. Literally, joy is part of the conversation now, so joy, enunciate.
Hi, Joy.
Good evening, you guys, or morning, on the other side of midnight.
Good morning.
Hi, Oberon.
Hi, Joy.
Okay, speaking of synchronicities, I'm listening to your conversation, and you seem to be having a lot of them, both of you. it's a really interesting interweaving of concepts and things, and you guys seem to resonate really incredibly well. So it's been wonderful listening to you talk. But Oberon and I have some synchronicities, too. And I wouldn't be where I am right now, and you wouldn't be talking to him right now if I hadn't met Oberon way back in 1980 when he was at the Renaissance Fair. With the unicorns, and but I didn't know Oberon then. I only remember meeting the unicorns, and then I met him again in 1992 when I went to a ecumenical conference. I think it was called Ecumenicon in Baltimore.
Yes,
and we hit it off really, really well. And the interesting thing about intentionality and synchronicities and all of that is that one of the things I had been visualizing while I was living in the D.C. area was that I wanted to live in California on a cooperative in the Redwoods with a husky. That was my visualization I kept putting into the
universe. With a husky?
With a husky.
Like Sergeant Preston's Yukon King?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
And had it not been for my re-meeting Oberon again, I never would have met my husband, who was also a priest in the Church of All Worlds. And now I'm living on a cooperative in the Redwoods in California and had a husky here with a husband, which was not in my picture. But that's what knitted all these things together. And I've been friends with Oberon now, 20 years? 25 years, right?
Right.
So anyway, I wanted to call in and talk about how this magic stuff really does work.
Hmm. Are you finding it's easier now to bring things into alignment than it used to be?
For myself?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely think there's a different kind of energy going on right now. But it's been a gradual thing. It's not like boom overnight. It's maybe it's because I'm noticing it more, but I'm wondering if it's because it's happening more.
Well, that's the big question, and that's why I asked Oberon, you know, have you noticed? Oberon, I presume you've kept manuals or books or diaries to write down sequences of things and rituals and spells and the other stuff that wizards do, so you can actually have a record to look back on?
Oh yes, I've kept my journals and written accounts of many of the things I've done and published several books that have put all that stuff out for people. It doesn't really do you any good to know stuff if you don't tell anybody about it, I've come to realize. So writing books has become part of my work now, as with yours, in full of my own collection of weird stuff, much like yours do, which I really enjoy, by the way. We are very much on a wavelength with so much stuff. I can see us both jumping up and down on the same end of the group.
I had a really interesting experience a few weeks ago. A friend of mine that I knew kind of distantly, you know, we hadn't shared a lot of stuff, called me up one night and said, I've just done this very strange ritual. And he went through the ritual, and it had to do with candles and timing and all that. And he was basically doing it to get an air conditioner.
Okay.
All right. Now, now, because of a lot of cross-current things that I'm not at liberty to discuss, this individual wound up not getting an air conditioner, but getting something much more important and much more valuable. In fact, it may have changed his life in certain very meaningful ways, just because he set up a ritual to go through a process to result in an air conditioner. Are we living now at a time when, because the physics is changing, these skills, these spells, these rituals, we have to kind of look at them very carefully, because you have to be careful what you ask for?
Oh boy, you've nailed it right there. I've thought about this a lot. You know, when you start seeing that your whims might manifest, you know, you have to be very careful what it is that you intend, because your intentions have a physical manifestation, and it can almost be kind of scary. And you've got to avoid going off on the paranoid crazy end of the thing too. You know, well, if I think it, then it will be so. But there is an extent into which there's truth to that, you know, because we're creating harmonic resonances. We're creating morphogenetic vortices.
I mean, isn't one of the definitions of the difference between a wizard and a magician is magicians are learning and wizards are grounded, so they know things can get out of hand, a la the Sorcerer's Apprentice?
Well, there's a certain amount of that, but that has more to do with the state you're at, whether you're an apprentice or a journeyman or a master in your field, you know. And we, in the Gray School of Wizardry, we have it organized at the school, and the books that I've written for it so far are basically dealing with the apprentice level, but we're moving into the journeyman level. We now have a number of graduates who are journeyman wizards, for instance, and we're developing the journeyman levels of the school to take it to the next place. So it all goes, the real difference between the wizard and the sorcerer in the mythology, for example, is that the wizard seeks to serve, whereas the sorcerer seeks to be served. And I think that's critical. I call it Lucifer's choice, because in the Divine Comedy, Lucifer says, I would rather rule in hell than serve in heaven. And that concept between ruling and serving is a major distinction between wizards and other people who pursue the magical paths, who want to do it to amass power. So wizardry is about knowledge and wisdom, and magic and sorcery is about power. But you really have to have both. I mean, wisdom and knowledge without power is impotent, but power without knowledge and wisdom is dangerous.
Can I make a point? So
the balance is the crucial thing with all of this.
Joy, by all means, come in.
Yeah, what I was going to say is, now my only real experience with the Sorcerer's Apprentice is from Fantasia, but if you notice, Mickey Mouse was trying to get out of doing the work.
Right.
And that's why he got out of hand. And there's something you also learn in magic, is that you have to do the work as well as the ritual. You have to do the things that bring about what you're looking for. The ritual, the magic is in getting your mindset in there, but you really have to do the work. I mean, you can't find a job if you just do a spell and you don't go look for a job. You know, you have to do the work.
Mm.
Because this is all part of the synergy of your magic intersecting with your life.
I had a Victorian grandmother, and one of her precepts, remember she was a Victorian grandmother, was, you know, work as if no prayer would help and pray as if no work would help.
That's a good one. That's wisdom.
That's good. I like that.
Yeah, that was very wise. There's a saying in Christianity that God helps those who help themselves, you know?
Yep.
And I think there's a realization across all the realms where magical principles are utilized, whether people think of them as prayers or spells, that you actually do have to do the work of some sort. You can't, if you're going to work to do a working, a magic, to win the lottery, you actually do have to go out and buy the tickets, you know?
See, one of the things that concerns me is that we're living in an era where I can point to objective scientific measurement that this stuff is working better. Because the way the equations work, you know, the thresholds, the background is rising.
Yes.
So that it's becoming more pervasive in an EM world. What do you do with people who are emotional, who are short-sighted, who can fly off the handle, who are mentally challenged, if not mentally ill? How do we guide people in this situation where your random thoughts can take on action that you may not intend, because the physics is now to where certain resonant people, even if inadvertently, in a spite of anger or in an emotional moment, can actually have terrible consequences on their surroundings, the people that they love, the people that they're in confrontation with? In other words, how do you teach wisdom?
Boy, that's a toughie. If we can ever figure that out completely, we can change the world to be a much better place.
Well, you created a school, I presume, to do this.
Yes. Well, you created a school that people come to it because they want to learn wisdom. And if people want to learn it, then they can be taught. But if they don't want to learn it, if they're in fact adamantly resistant to learning something, it's pretty damn hard to teach it to them, you know?
Well, wait. In an era where people look upon this stuff as all crazy, and I got some interesting emails about, oh, you're going to waste another, you know, 2 hours of my night. Like that individual, he does not have to listen if he does not want to. But no, it's not a waste of time, because as I'm looking at this, there's an awful lot of people whose actions and mental connections are making things occur that they don't want to occur, and they haven't the clue, because they live in a universe where we've been disconnected from the idea that mental discipline can result in mental effects.
Precisely, which is why I emphasize the importance of not losing the term religion, because that means reconnecting. And that loss of connection, that alienation, that separation is part of the PTSD of Western civilization phenomenon. Well, there are lots of things you can do for people, but they have to seek something. You know, sending somebody on a vision quest or guiding somebody through one can be very helpful. Simply working with people, getting people into something that brings the other side out more, like art and music. These things can help to people. People are disconnected with themselves. Usually there's the people who are really screwed up like this are having a disconnect between their right and left hemispheres kind of stuff. You know, on one, it's like the popular cartoon image of the little devil on one shoulder, mm-hmm. the little angel on the other shoulder. And the trick is to bring them together and harmonize them. And there are lots of ways of harmonizing the hemispheres. And one of them, very interestingly, is occurring with increasing frequency in popular media, and that's 3D movies. Because when you watch a 3D movie, you have to have both eyes working harmoniously to create the images in the opposite hemispheres of your brain that will integrate.
And so I figured this out when Hollywood strikes again.
Yes. I know. A movie like Avatar in 3D is a powerful teaching device. You know, it really is.
So this is the prescription against polarization.
Yes, precisely.
Hey, Richard?
Yeah. Oh, this disembodied voice is Scott. We have him laboring in the back room.
Yes, he's chained to the desk. Now, you were talking, you and Oberon were talking about seeking wisdom and finding wisdom. It caused me to think of, I think it was an old New Yorker cartoon sometime back. There was like a lobby at a hotel where the conference rooms are, and there was a sign over each door. And over one door, it said, happiness. And over the other door, it said, lecture about happiness. And I'll let you guess which door had the longest line to get in. It was obviously the lecture about happiness. People want to hear about it, but when they can walk right through the door and have it, it's too simple. It's not interesting enough. Let's listen to somebody expound upon happiness and see how that works.
Yeah. Well, and that's tough these days because there's so much bogus stuff and so many scams and shams out there. We've had people being suspicious of the gray school, that we can't possibly be legitimate. We must be some kind of a scam, just trying to fish their data or something. And sometimes it's really challenging, to, because that's total scams look very convincing and very authentic, you know. So it's hard.
Well, I think
hard.
Maybe some people think that you can just wiggle your nose and clean up the living room.
And well, that's because they watch too many episodes of Bewitched.
Yeah.
Hold it there.
I'd love to be able to do that, but
hold it there. We're at the bottom of the hour. Okay. My guest this morning is Oberon Zell, an arch wizard, and we're discussing magic and how it can work in all our lives if we're just kind of tuned in. More music from Nick and Chris. You're on the other side of midnight. My name's Richard C. Hoagland. We shall return. And we are back on the other side of midnight with my guest this morning, Oberon Zell. Oberon, you wanted to talk more about the school, and I want you to talk more about the school, because it seems to me in a shifting environment where people could inadvertently make stuff happen, schooling is really important to let people know what could happen.
Yes, it is. I feel that as people are developing new abilities, talents, powers, whatever you want to consider them, that training these to be utilized in a right way is a very good idea. That was sort of the principle behind the Professor Xavier's School for Gifted Youngsters in the X-Men series, is all these mutants with all kinds of strange powers and need to be trained up. And really, in a sense, I think we all of us in this realm are mutants of some sort. We're developing what many of us see is the emergence of the next phase of human evolution, really, as we start opening up more of these things. Now, it's quite possible that many of these things were opened once upon a time in the past.
Well, see, that gets back to the idea. That gets the idea over on that we're looking at cycles.
Yes,
that
exactly.
That we go through dumbness periods and smartness periods. We go through connection periods and disconnection periods. And again, from our model, we're reconnecting to an awful lot of ancient stuff, including the frequencies, the energies, the physics that makes mind over matter work. But we have a whole bunch of people that they see it in the movies, they see it in television. It looks interesting, it looks entertaining, and they haven't a clue how to discipline it in their own lives because most people don't really want to acknowledge it might actually, good grief, it might actually be for real.
Right. Well, we created the school to provide that kind of training, that which all of us who are members of the Gray Council wish that we had been able to have access to when we were starting on the path. Just as is my first book, The Grimoire for the Apprentice Wizard, was designed to be the kind of book I wish I'd gotten a hold of when I was about 11 that would have had everything I needed to know.
And so you wound up writing the book that you wanted to read.
Exactly. And I've done that with everything. I've created statues that I want to have on my altar. I created a magazine I wanted to read. I created a church I wanted to belong to. I created the kind of school that I wished I could have attended. That kind of stuff, that's been kind of the way I've run my life in the project. So the school was a major part of that, and I'm very proud of it. We've got students in 50 countries around the world. We've got about 400 students and 30-some teachers right now. And over 450 classes in 16 departments at 7 levels. It's quite an amazing thing. I really recommend it.
Oh, my God, it sounds like a bureaucracy.
Well, there are people running things, and there are people who have administrative stuff, but I'm the overall headmaster, and I try to keep it from being too outrageous in that regard. But we do manage to run a school and teach cool stuff.
Okay, so since this is a participatory community, that's what the show is.
Yeah.
How does one join the school and what does one learn? What's in the syllabus?
Well, to join the school, you go to the website, which is greyschool.com, G-R-E-Y, school.com. And there's all, you can look up, there's the class outlines. You can look up the department synopsis. There's a syllabus listed for each class, so you can look up what they are. And it's all right there, in right out in the open, before you even sign up to enroll in the school.
Oh, I love this one. Keep magical education affordable.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And this has been a major part of it. We've been just, you know, really as reasonably priced as we can possibly do and still survive.
The Gray School can now be found in Second Life?
Yes. We've now developed an entire Second Life virtual campus with Castle.
For people who have no idea what a First Life is, tell them what Second Life is.
Right. Well, it's an alternative. It's an auxiliary school, as it were. And it's neat because you can visit in person with people. We have meetings and rituals and things there where people can visit with each other and see each other in person. You can take classes from teachers that you're actually interacting with on a personal level, and demonstrations can be made and stuff.
So this is kind of Harry Potter for real. What does the syllabus look like? What does a prospective student out there on the internet tonight, anywhere on the planet, listening to this show saying, I could use a little more magic in my life. What do they go about doing? How do they begin?
Well, there's 16 departments, and so you can explore these and choose whatever you want as a major. It begins by just simply signing in, and you get introduced to the school. There's a sorting system that places you in an elemental house or lodge, depending on your age, and that puts you into a community of people. There's conversations, there's forums, there's the classes themselves, of course. There's clubs, there's summer camps. Called conclaves, in which local students and teachers will get together for a week to 10 days or so. There's just lots of stuff going on. There's challenges. There's things that people do outside. There's local meetups for community. And our latest extension that we're really excited about right now is the Academy of Arcana that we're opening up here in Santa Cruz, where I've just moved just recently. In California, Santa Cruz, California, which is a wonderful place to be. And we're right now just setting it up. And we're looking forward to having classes in workshops in the academy building. So that will take it to another level of physicality. And a lot of our students are so excited about the academy itself that they're wanting to set up local academies in different towns and cities. So this could just explode all over the place.
So this is kind of like a library, a museum, a coterie of magic and mystery.
Exactly. Over our 40 years together, Morning Glory and I developed quite a collection of books and artifacts, images, in all sorts of areas, not just magic, but areas like paleontology and anatomy and you know, science fiction and astrophysics and all kinds of cool stuff. And so this will be a museum that will exhibit these kinds of things. There will be a meeting place, kind of a universal temple meeting place. And the core of it, right in the center, will be the library and museum. And up in the front of the building, which we're presently just installing at this very moment, will be a little gift store that will have stuff that consignment arts and crafts from local artists and our own work and stuff. So it's quite a project we're developing here. And this is our first physical campus for the school. So it's a very exciting phase. And we've got tremendous support within the school and without it and from the local Santa Cruz community. All the local pagans and magical people are all very excited about it. And we'll hear more as it goes on. Hopefully next time we get together, you'll be down here, and we can show you around.
Well, that sounds like an interesting adventure.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I'm going to sign off, you guys. But
okay, Joy.
I'm so glad you did this interview, and hopefully somebody else will call in to get in on the conversation.
We will entertain the calls exactly like that. In fact, let me give out our number, if I can find the right piece of paper.
Bye. I love you guys.
Okay. Bye, Joy.
Bye, Joy.
Okay. The number is 505. I've got it here somewhere. 505-796-8802. 505-796-8802. Or if you're on Skype, Enterprise Mission, yeah, we could have some folks call in while we have a few minutes till the end of the hour. So anyone in the world can log on to the website and become part of the school.
Yep, anywhere in the world that you can get an internet connection. That's the beauty of it. It exists in this magical realm. The internet itself is a magical realm. And it's very cool that we're teaching magic in the realm of magic. And like I said, with 16 different departments, students can come and learn about healing, herbalism, alchemy, magical sciences, mathemagics, divination, cosmology, life ways is one of them. We even have a department of dark arts that people can learn sorcery and hoodoo and learn about creatures of the night and things that go bump in the night and that kind of stuff.
Okay.
It's really quite a lot there, really. And it's all available. We've had some students who've continued past their 7 levels for graduation and still stay around and keep on taking more stuff. And because we were surprised when we opened it. We thought it was going to be basically for teenagers. And when we very first opened 11 years ago, three-quarters of the students who signed up were adults. So we had to do some quick rethinking and regrouping and redesigning of our classes and programs to accommodate that.
Hmm. Okay, we have someone who's just joined us.
Cool.
Who are you and where are you calling from?
Oh, hi, Richard. My name is Nisa, and I'm calling from Hawaii.
Oh, Lisa.
Hawaii.
From Hawaii, yes, yes. It's gorgeous out there.
It's raining here.
Oh, no.
But it's good because it's winter. I mean, for us anyway.
Okay.
But over on... Such a great show. Thank you, Richard. I love this. Anyway, I just wanted a little bit of help when you were talking about, concentrating and thinking about something and then it comes through. I've been kind of working with that skill in my life and I'm beginning to see synchronicities. But then I get confused because then people say you keep the image in your head and, you know, eventually the synchronicities will come through and then it'll manifest. And then there are people that say, well, the magic ingredient is detachment. So, you know, with intention and then belief and just detach.
It's so interesting you should ask this question because...
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you, let me finish with your question and then I'll ask mine because they're so connected.
Yeah. Well, you know, both ways it would help, but then I tend to maybe think too much. And then when that happens, then I kind of fog up the intention part because then doubt starts to seep in. And then when I, you know, detach, I get confused because is that what, it's not really giving it up. It's knowing with intention that it'll come through, right? But then there's another part of me that says, well, you know, nothing's happening because then impatience get into the picture. And I have to find the middle road to where I can... I'm almost getting it.
Patience
there.
Is a key part, Oberon.
Well, yes. The part where you have to release the spell to go out and do its work is part of the magic and part of the structure of a ritual. This is why a lot of this stuff is done in a ritual form, where you have a beginning, a middle, and an end to the ritual. You set the intention and the purpose, and you do the setting up part, and then you finish it all up. But on a practical level of just doing it, taking it into the dreaming, going to sleep with it, creates that release that you need to do to send it out into the quantum field, if you wish to use that particular metaphor, the realm of whatever, spirit, probabilities, possibilities, all of that. And it allows the probabilities to rearrange themselves in that direction. And magic is the art of probabilities. It's not a certain solid thing like, hard science. It's much more... nebulous. But in reality, as we're coming to understand, everything is all about probabilities, you know, including things at the subatomic level. It's all matters of probabilities. There is no true certainties.
But see, as the physics changes, I'm noticing these improbabilities are becoming more probable.
Precisely. Exactly.
I mean, like, what are the probabilities that Donald Trump would actually run for president?
Oh, that's absurd. That could never happen.
and that on an airplane, actually it was a helicopter, when one of the kids at the Iowa State Fair asked him if he was Batman, really, he said yes.
Oh, shit. Really?
Again, be careful what you wish for. We have a new caller. Joe, you joined the conversation. What would you like to ask?
Yes, good evening, Richard. And Oberon, I am a midnight rider calling in. And Oberon, I met you and your wife, Morning Glory. My condolences on her loss. I know she's in the Summerland. Yep. And I have been following Magical Path since 1978. And I started following Gardnerian. And over the years, it has kind of morphed, you know, with Saxon, with Wicca from Buckland, Ray Buckland. And now it has become, you know, my own personal magic. You know, it's me and it's my animals. And it is following the eight great festivals. You know, we have the four major and the four minor. And mm-hmm. It is just, you know, it is so beautiful hearing you. And I met you in 1983 at San Diego Renaissance Festival when you had Lancelot, your little unicorn, who was born on the summer solstice.
Yes.
Yes. How long did Lancelot live?
Let's see. He was about 11, as I recall, when he died.
That was a
nice run that he had. He was remarkable. He was just an amazing being. Incredible.
I know. I felt it because you allowed me to stroke his hair on his back, and I touched his horn for a little bit of magic.
Yep.
Yes. Well, thank you, Oberon, and I'm just so happy to speak with you again after all these years, and I am just so totally with you.
Thank you.
All I can say.
All right.
Blessings.
Thanks for calling in.
Blessed be.
Thank you. Bright blessings. Thank you, Richard.
I'm going to take my exit too, Richard and Oberon.
Okay.
Big aloha to you guys, and thank you so much. I love your show, Richard. Thank you so much.
Thank you, dear.
Bye.
Bye. Okay, we've got a few minutes left, about maybe 10 minutes. Returning to the school, so what are the criteria? I mean, obviously, it must be pretty inexpensive because nobody these days can afford something that's expensive. But how do people come to you, and what is it they're looking to achieve when they join the school?
Well, many people come because they hear about the school from either reading my books or from shows like this one or our public appearances. I do a lot of appearances all over the place, and so do other people. Word of mouth. We've done little analyses asking people where they hear about it, and it's been interesting. And they come because they want something more. They want something a little deeper. They're looking for something that's, well, perhaps you could say on the other side of midnight, you know, which I think is a nice way. I love that title, by the way. It's really
great. Thank you. James has joined the conversation. James, what do you want to ask?
I'd like to ask, do you know anything about the Emerald Tablets of Thoth? Because I've read them, and it seems like if they're actually like 3,600 years old, they'd be like the very beginning of all magic. And would you agree on that?
Well, no, they're not 3,600 years old. The Emerald Tablets there's just a statement, essentially, that's kind of the foundation of the principles of magic, particularly the as above, so below principle, which is kind of core to the whole thing. And it's a statement of the kind of resonance of everything being interconnected kind of stuff. And it's a great truth. See, the distinction between great truths and small truths are small truths, the opposite is false. But with great truths, the opposite is also true. And as above, so below is one of those great truths. So the opposite, as below, so above, is also true. And so is as within, so without. And all this relates to how one thinks of magic, as doing something on a small scale affects things on a larger scale. So a lot of magical work is done in a micro setting that is implied, therefore, to affect the greater system beyond it. It's like developing a little program and then sending it out into the world to do. The Emerald Tablet comes out of the Hermetic tradition, really, which developed in the Middle Ages, and it's a very beautiful statement, and it aligns some of the principles: the Earth, the Sun, the Moon, as archetypal forces. But the importance of it really is that Whatever we do on a small scale here affects the larger universe around it, and we are also affected by that. That's really what it's all about.
So you don't think they were actually made by Thoth, the Atlantean king?
No, but I don't want to go into a thing about the Atlantean mythology. It's delightful stuff, but it is almost entirely fantasy. So enjoy it as good fantasy and science fiction and mythology, but don't consider it to be history.
Okay.
Okay. Right, well,
thank you very much.
All righty. You have a good morning.
You too. And I love your show, Mr. Hoagland. Thank you.
Oh, call me Richard. Come on.
Okay, Richard.
Okay. Later. Bye.
Okay.
Okay, Oberon. Again, in an era where people have powers or are reconnecting with resonances they didn't know they had, I mean, I've watched people try to do experiments with Ouija boards who should be nowhere near a Ouija board. I mean, the awesome power that could be unleashed if one does Ouija boards on live radio or live television and reaches millions of people. I mean, talk a bit to the idea that we have to be aware that our power now can exceed our capabilities to know what we're doing, because the physics is changing and what we thought was just a game, in fact, in many cases, is not.
Yeah, it's all fun and games until somebody loses an eye. And that's certainly true, of course, but you know, people are going to do what they want to do. If somebody wants to mess around with stuff they shouldn't mess around with, you're not going to stop them by telling them not to, you know. That's the problem about the whole thing. And so there's always going to be people that will burn themselves out one way or another. And it happens all around, not just in magic, but in life. I mean, you know, people who go off on lose themselves in drugs or alcohol or other crazy things. You can't really prevent people from doing that. You can provide alternatives, information, education. I think the best way of addressing all these issues, frankly, is to develop cultural mythos and stories that impel people by inspiration into the right directions. If people don't have any inspiration, if they don't have any dream or vision, then they're lost.
But isn't that what the Marvel Universe is doing, and the DC Universe, and all the mega tentpole pictures that now suddenly have taken all these mythos that came over the last 30, 40, 50 years from people like Jack Kirby, and we're making them into real flesh and blood archetypes.
It is precisely that. There's an amazing book that I read recently called Mutants and Mystics, Science Fiction, Superhero Comics, and the Paranormal by Jeffrey Kripal, that's brilliant, and that's what it's all about. Mm. It analyzes the history of the whole superhero mythos through cycles from mutants to aliens to an emergence of a new subspecies of humanity and all these different things, and how each of the people involved in this in various ways, from writers like Philip K. Dick and Neil Gaiman to Simon and Schuster with Superman and all this stuff, this has been an emergence of a new cultural mythos. I really recommend the book, Mutants and Mystics. It's brilliant.
Mutants and Mystics, and the author is
Jeffrey J. Kripal, Kripal, Mutants and Mystics.
Okay. Scott, we have to make a note of that. We're going to go after Mr. Kripal to be a guest on the other side of midnight, because I'd like to talk at great length about that.
Yeah, absolutely. Brilliant.
Okay, we have added another caller to the conversation. Who are you, and sign in, please?
Hi, this is Larry in Louisiana.
Hi, Larry.
I'd like to ask Oberon, what's your opinion on the Los Lunas Decalog stone inscription? Do you think it's the real thing? And by star inscription at the stones, it dates to 8,000 B.C.
Give me that again. What was the particular one? I didn't quite hear it.
The Los Lunas Decalog stone inscription.
The Los Lunas Decalog stone and inscription. I am not familiar with that.
Is that the one that's supposed to be here near Albuquerque?
Yeah, it's just outside of Los Lunas, and is a star inscription in the stones with the writing, which is in Phoenician and Paleo-Hebrew. And the star inscription, if you bring the constellations back to match it, it dates to 8,000 B.C.
The problem is, and I've seen a show, I think, on Discover on this, there's a famous forensic geologist named Walter, I think. he looks with a microscope at the incisions at the very base of the grooves in the rock, and with a combination of knowing the rate at which desert varnish forms and being able to look with very high microscopy at the small incisions and changes in the depth of the cut in the rock, he's pretty much established that particular epigraphy, that text in that rock is probably not real. It's probably a fake. It was probably done sometime in the last 50, 60 years, left out here in the New Mexico deserts. But from his analysis, it doesn't have the characteristics of an ancient engraved stone.
Okay, well, the Boy Scouts used to go talk over the letters every year. Maybe that's what caused that effect.
Well, yeah. But see, when you damage something original, when you do something to it, you add a material, you add gunk, you add petroleum products, you try to, you know, scrape it out with a knife or a switchblade or something, you do irrevocable damage to the ability to decide whether it's real or not, because the only way that a forensic expert could determine if it's real is looking at the pristine aged process of the engraving in the original stone subjected to desert environment, and unfortunately with that we can no longer do that. But I thank you for calling in and raising the issue, because it's part of this heritage that we need to be paying more attention to. Thank you much.
All right.
Okay, Oberon, we've got a couple of minutes left. Anything we didn't touch on in our first conversation?
Well, I certainly would like to, again, encourage people to check out some of the websites, or just Google me and check out the things that are there, because there's just so much more information. I've got a number of books out that address these issues, and if these things really interest somebody, please check it out. The Academy of Arcana has got brand new updating, and so it's online, academyofarcana.com.
You know, I find it so interesting that one of the major networks, I forget which one, has got the series called The Librarians.
Oh, yes.
Which is kind of like in parallel to Warehouse 13 over on Sci-Fi.
Yes.
Except The Librarians, the basis of their pursuits, their forensic investigations, is all about magic coming back, magic taking its place alongside the intellectual left side of the brain, science, as we move forward in this changing of the world age. And I just find the timing so interesting to educate people as to possibilities. But then they need to go from television to your school to actually get the background and the straight skinny and how to do this for real and how to do it at some level of professionalism.
Absolutely. I'm fascinated by seeing this emerging mythos occurring over the last 50 years or so that I've been involved in all this. It's just incredibly exciting to see it happening and coming alive. I mean,
almost like it was supposed to.
Yes, exactly. I mean, when I first started claiming the term pagan back in 1967, it was hard to imagine that it would be a worldwide movement of millions of people now and all of that stuff. So this is wonderful. I'm really excited about it. As you say, well, it's one of these. You can steam engine when it's steam engine time, and it's definitely seems to be that for the return of magic. And the popular myths that are emerging, the TV shows, the novels, the things that catch on, the movies.
And unfortunately, we're out of time. Oberon Zell, Archmage, Archwizard, we shall do this again.
Good.
You've been on the other side of midnight. My name's Richard C. Hoagland. And until tomorrow morning, same time, same channel, remember, third star on the left, straight on till morning. Good night, everyone.